And we're back here on the flip side of the of podcast number two for Revolution 236. I am Revolution, and what we were talking about was the problems that must be addressed in this country with regards to education if we are ever to truly begin to make inroads or to establish a new foundation or to cut into the foundation of what the collectivist left has managed to propagate over the course of roughly the past four decades. And as I would like to point out, and I think most everybody probably knows, all of this comes back to the foundation, which is education. And the problems with education in this country have reached a critical stage. The way education is being approached, or the problems with regards to education are being approached by those in the Democratic Party, the metaphor that I like to use is that of a 15-year-old wreck of a car. Okay, if you're a person who you're in the middle class or maybe lower middle class, whatever your fortunes may be, you are limited to a 15-year-old wreck of a car, and you depend upon that car in order to get you from point A to point B, from home to work, whatever other necessary driving you need to do. And in order to keep that car going, you have to keep putting financial bandages on it in order to keep it moving along. Much is the same, or it's very much the same, in our public educational system now, because the Democrats aren't interested at all in, I should say, not just the Democrats, but really the progressive liberals. They have no interest in repairing the educational system. See, those on the left are destroyers by nature. Whether they are consciously aware of the fact that they're destroying things or not, I don't know. Sometimes it's clearly the case that they're just interested in implementing their ideas and their ideals, and they don't really pay attention to the damage that they cause in order to put these unnatural initiatives in place. But in any event, the progressive liberals, most of which obviously are in the Democratic Party, in order to keep their loosely consolidated voting bloc together, one of which is public employees, they have to keep funneling millions of dollars into failed educational systems. And by now, I would hope that most people in this country can see that the more money you simply throw at a problem, whatever it may be, the worse the problem gets, because people become dependent on the handouts and nobody pays attention to fixing the real issues. So, therefore, I think my metaphor is an apt one. These Democratic representatives are only interested in bandaging the problem, shoring up votes with money, and the educational infrastructure suffers. The public school system, now, on top of this, obviously, you have the problem that the public educational system has been completely, I would say, more or less 100%, close to 100% infiltrated with progressives. And at this point, if a parent is opting to send his or her child into the public system, the leftist indoctrination, I realize that that's a strong word, but it is what it is. The leftist collectivist indoctrination is starting as early as kindergarten. It may not be as visible from K through 8, but it certainly starts to become much more visible in high school, and by the time you reach higher education in America nowadays, it's basically just political indoctrination, under the guise of real teaching. Okay, it's long ago. The our higher educational system, which was once the model on the planet, fell to the forces of the collectivist left a long, long time ago, to the point at which conservative activists, they're basically, I don't want to say banned, but yeah, for the most part they are. I think there are free speech zones on colleges now, these very, very small regulated areas where you can actually speak your mind, which is completely contrary to what America and real education is supposed to be about. They are, the left would have you believe that they are all about free speech, when in fact they detest the idea of free speech, simply because if the conservative ideas were ever fully expressed, people wouldn't, they would have no interest in buying what the left, I was going to say what the left sells to us, but really it's not a case of selling anything to us, it's what the left forces on us, because throughout history, the political left in this country, excuse me, the political left worldwide, whenever it is a leftist movement, a collectivist movement, it must use force in order to get its ideas implemented against the will of innocent people. So, in any event, my question becomes about school choice. My real question here, it comes down to school choice, which is becoming more and more of a very, very hot button issue. You obviously have on one side parents who want to be able to choose for themselves where their kids go to school, and I mean, I have to ask, in America, why is this even a question? Why is this even a question as to whether or not a parent has the right to choose where to send his or her child to school? It doesn't make a lot of sense. It makes zero sense. On the other side, you have the unions, who they want strict control over everything with regards to the financial matters of their employees. At this point, the unions have little to do with public employee protection, and more so, they're there just to collect union dues and to send them along to their Democratic representatives, who in turn obviously will give them more benefits, and or at least try to get them more and more benefits. But why is the choice to choose for your children in America the school that you think best, why is that choice under attack from the people who purport to be our representatives and our leaders? It's very simple. If you were to allow people to have that choice to go to a private school where truth and free thought would actually rule the day, as they once did in this country, that is what I would call a macro-level threat, or what others might term an existential threat, to what essentially has become our political aristocracy. Remember one thing, I suppose you could say two things. Remember one general idea. There are two things that oppressors always try to take away from those that they're trying to oppress. They try to take away their access to knowledge and their access to guns. It's that simple. And I think we're especially now with the 23 executive initiatives by Barack Obama, we're now beginning to see, along with education, that we are in the process of being oppressed. There's to think otherwise is simply foolishness. If you're one of those who, you know, is living under the umbrella of what's called the normalcy bias. Well, none of this stuff will happen. This is just life, and I'm just going to live my daily life. And it's, if people do not If people do not continue to speak up, this country will radically change for the worse in the course of the next 4 to 10 years. As I was saying about choice, restricting choice to, say, you know, the choice to, you know, choice to quality education and whether or not you want to have a firearm to protect yourself. Remember one thing from one of the greatest movie series of the recent 15 years or so, the Matrix trilogy. Keanu Reeves' character Neo said, very aptly, the problem is choice. They must take free choice away from the American people, not just in education, but in everything. Ironically, when you take a step to the side here and look at the abortion debate, they'll claim they're pro-choice, but they're pro-choice only when it comes to murdering innocent children. They're decidedly anti-choice when it comes to everything else. But in any event, moving on with the discussion, I'm just checking my notes here, with regards to the education, the problem, school choice dilemma. Just trying to collect my thoughts here. I suppose what I would need to move along and discuss at this point is how this situation has evolved and developed in the public system. And I think in order to truly understand that, we have to go all the way back to the late 60s and the early 70s. And look at the beginnings of the, what's probably most aptly termed, the unholy alliance that is now shared between what's called the New Left and the public, the New Left being a much more violent form of progressivism and liberalism, the New Left and the unions. And I suppose, in a sense, you could say that the first Occupy demonstration really was the one that took place at Woodstock. Ironically, that was the young people at Woodstock were the product of real entitlement. They were raised spoiled, rotten, more or less in the comforts of wealth and luxury that had been accumulated by the people, their parents, who were part of the greatest generation this country had ever seen. In any event, for whatever reason they had to hate the system that had given them so much, once their late 60s protests began to lose some fuel, they realized that if they were going to continue their movement, that they were going to have to, they needed new fuel for their fire, they needed to adjust, they needed to redirect. And one of the ways that they decided, or maybe the primary way, was that they were going to play the middle class game. And they were going to enter middle class life and wear their shirts and ties and their suits. And they were going to spread their ideas that way. And one of the most pervasive and damaging professions into which they entered was the educational field. And I can quote you something from two members of the New Left themselves. Their names were, I assume that they're probably still with us. They wrote a book. Their names are Susan Gushy O'Malley and Robert C. Rosen. And the name of their book was Politics of Education, Essays from Radical Teacher. And one of their passages there says, "If we protested against racism and the war on the streets and in Washington, we felt there is something that we ought to be able to do about it in school. The challenge to the society implied a challenge to our workplace. Okay, these are people who entered the public sector. As to what I was saying before, the choice or the redirect that they took with regards to entering the middle class, so to speak, and playing the game, or as Van Jones said, to drop the radical pose in an effort to find to obtain the more satisfying radical ends. Another passage from a site called History as a Weapon reads, "A large contingent relocated from college towns to large cities, moved into working-class neighborhoods, and took jobs in auto plants, other industrial sectors, post offices, hospitals, or public schools. Flush with optimism, they believed prospects were good for building a solid base in what seemed an increasingly restive and angry working class." I really never realized that the working class in America was angry. But be that as it may, I continue. "There were more and harder fought strikes in 1969 and 1970 than there had been in any year since 1946. The early 1970s also saw the outbreak of rank-and-file insurgent movements in a number of major unions," what a surprise, "with black workers, young workers, and often Vietnam vets in the forefront." So, really, once this mindset, this radical mindset, merged with the public education system and the demands that they were putting on Democratic politicians and school systems nationwide, the problems began to grow, I don't want to say exponentially, but they certainly grew more than gradually, to the point at which our public system, school system today, is unrecognizable, by and large. Okay, speaking from, and as I pointed out before, I'm pretty uniquely qualified to discuss on these ideas, simply because I'm now an educator of 2 decades in the private sector. I'm an administrator, as I pointed out, at one of the most successful private schools in the region in which in which our school is found. And we have, much like many other private schools, there are times when we have openings, or I should say there have been times when we have hired retired public school teachers, which more often than not has turned out to be somewhat problematic, because most of the time, retired public school teachers come to our school and they view it as the equivalent of a Lifetime Achievement Award or something, because since they've put their time in on the front lines, so to speak, they feel entitled to not only the really generous public school state pension that they're getting from the taxpayers, but also a reasonable paycheck from us, in addition to the fact that teaching at our school is like actually teaching. It's actually education. And what often, we have seen all too often take place is that these teachers come and don't really do their job. They just mail it in, and meanwhile, all the while feeling entitled to not one but 2 paychecks. And the vast majority of the faculty and staff at our school very quickly begins to resent them, because they are making, I don't want to say considerably less, but they're making less. Now, that's by our own choice, granted. Okay, I would say the majority of the faculty at our school gladly accept, you know, roughly, we'll say 15% less in their yearly checks for the opportunity to teach at our school, because they can actually come, they can actually arrive and leave with peace of mind, and they can actually do their job. So consequently, the more often than not, the employment of these retired public school teachers doesn't last very long. Excuse me, but we do have 2 teachers who have two retired public school teachers who have been with us for over 10 years and are worth their weight in gold because they come to work every day. They never miss school. They'll do anything for anyone. They always do their job. And interestingly enough, they tell horror stories about what's taking, I mean, even 10 to 15 years ago, what was taking place with public sector unions. And even as far back as, believe it or not, kind of stepping back to, you know, when I was referring to, you know, the late 60s, early 70s, one of these two men who was entering the profession in 1970 was also at that time going through witnessing his father's last days. And his father was part of that great generation. And he was a career pipe fitter. And he, you know, just to exaggerate, to make a point here, on his deathbed said to his son, who was entering the public sector union, he said, now this was 1970, 43 years ago, said, the unions once made this country great, but now they're trying to take over the country. That was 43 years ago. The unions, these two men have said time and time again to me in stories that they've told me that the unions today, more often than not, they're not there for you when you have an issue, but they certainly will come around to find you. They'll find you wherever you are if there's an important union vote coming up. There's a lot more that I have to say with regards to education, but let me finish off this first part. This is going to be a multi-part series on the podcast portion of the Revolution 236 site. So let me end off this first part by saying that parents need to, if they haven't already begun to realize it, they have to come to terms with the fact now that public schools are basically little more than adolescent daycare. The concept of daycare has basically evolved, and it has gone into public schools and especially public high schools. The public schools are now almost wholly run on the outcome-based methodology rather than achievement-based methodology. If you are a parent of a public school student and you happen to be listening to this, you have to understand that your children are not being challenged. They're certainly being told that they're the smartest things on God's green earth. They are not being challenged. They are not being forced to produce, not for, that's the wrong word. They are not being taught to achieve. They are not learning from their mistakes. Their self-esteem is being stroked and watered, flowered, okay, whatever you want to, however you'd like to refer to that. But see, this is the same. You can go look this up on the internet. This is the very same methodology that was employed by the Nazis. An outcome-based, holistic approach that gave service to the state. If that's what you like, fine. It's a free country. But the infrastructure of our public schools has failed. It has failed academically. It has failed morally, physically. The physical infrastructure is falling apart because there's simply no money to put into repairing your children's schools. Okay? All the money is going into the union bosses' pockets. It's going into union dues, and it's going into the teachers' pockets. And the teachers, to be perfectly honest, the good ones, they don't really have any reason to teach very hard. The public school, 20 years ago, over 20 years ago, I once said to someone, this is before I even entered, I was still studying to be a teacher. I said to several people, the public school system is nothing but a jobs program, and that's all it is. That's the way the Nazis viewed employment. They viewed employment as a jobs program. Okay, now I'm going to end part one right about here. I've got a lot more that I want to say on this. But I have articles that I want to write on other issues, and, you know, as I pointed out before, if I manage to build a following for this site, great. Then I can start doing maybe some video podcasts and some live call. I'm fully equipped to do live political call-in talk shows, but I'm not going to go to that. I'm not going to invest in that right now because I don't think know how productive that would be right now or how justified that would be. But in any event, I hope that the first part of this podcast on what we need to begin to realize what the problems are, and then about how we need to begin attacking it. I hope this has been helpful. In any event, this is Revolution, and we are the resistance. So it'd be great. I'd really appreciate it. Again, if you'd follow me at Revolution236 on Twitter. I also have, as I pointed out, a Facebook page. Okay, Revolution236, I believe. And I hope to see some comments. Okay, either on Twitter or on the site itself. Okay, so until next time, let's everyone stay strong and stay in the game.